brain is the organ of consciousness, right? And what we think of as the self, the mind, perception, and thought, lives inside our heads. But Alvin Noe, professor of philosophy at the University of California, argues that consciousness isn't an internal process, but rather an external activity. His new book is Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, published by Hill and Wang, and I'm very pleased it has brought Alvin Noe to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You're a philosopher taking on a scientific problem. Does your premise reflect the growing gaps caused by specialization in the various disciplines in the humanities and the sciences?
Actually, I'd say that in the sort of the intellectual world that I occupy, philosophers and scientists have a very good rapport. We're pretty close to each other. And that really reflects the fact that now that science is trying to turn its attention to the mind, they're in a philosophical landscape and they can't but help, you know, try to deal with that.
But there was a time when science came out of philosophy.
Yeah.
Pretty much every scientific discipline at one time or another was in the purview of philosophy, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think in some sense we see that right now very we're sort of witnessing that again, just as physics in the time of Newton's great work in physics was called the work in natural philosophy. What we have now is essentially the natural philosophy of the mind, and it involves people working in philosophy and linguistics and computer science and robotics and neuroscience.
What's the advantage of applying philosophical speculation instead of scientific empiricism to the study of consciousness?
Yeah, that's not the opposition. It's not about speculation versus empiricism. It's about trying to sharpen our grip on what the questions and problems are so that we can even try to begin to be empirical about them. One of the problems, I think, that the scientists that the scientists grapple with is that terms like consciousness, memory, perception are themselves so in need of sharpening before it's actually possible to investigate them empirically. And that's exactly where dialogue with philosophers can be helpful.
Isn't the scientific consensus that consciousness is a mechanical process with a neurological foundation?
Scientists often say that, but then the next sentence they say is, of course, we have no clue how that happens.
Is that the weakness of the theory, that they're unclear? Because there are a lot of things that we're unclear about. We don't know what caused the Big Bang, but pretty much everybody believes that there was a Big Bang.
Absolutely. So with this pretty comfortable agreement that there's a phenomenon here, and the question is to sharpen our appreciation of what the phenomenon is to figure out how to go forward. The assumption that the way to go forward is by looking at the brain alone actually reflects unreflective philosophical prejudice on behalf of the scientists, not something that they've learned through their scientific work.
So even though this idea is weak, it has remained in place, the idea that it's a mechanical process, because there's nothing that has been proposed to replace it?
It's the truth is, the whole problem of consciousness, the whole question of thought, feeling, experience, how the world shows up for us, has actually received very little attention by scientists. And it's only in the last 20 to 40 years that they're sort of turning their attention to it full force. And they're doing it armed with new technologies of brain imaging. And so what's happening is that with these new technologies and new tricks of the trade and sort of new scientific paradigms, they're revisiting old questions that in some sense haven't really changed their basic structure for four or 500 years.
Well, when Rene Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," he opened up a real can of worms.
That's right. I think most neuroscientists studying consciousness have a starting point which they shared with Descartes, which is the idea that inside each of us there's a thing. And that thing thinks and feels and decides, and we are that thing inside of us that thinks and feels and decides. Where they differ with Descartes is that Descartes thought it was something immaterial. They think it's something material, namely the brain. But my claim is that they don't actually have any better understanding how the brain gives rise to it than Descartes did how the immaterial mind does.
My guess is Alvin Noe, whose book Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, is published by Hill and Wang. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what is your theory of consciousness, and how does your theory of consciousness differ from the popular consensus?
The question of consciousness, as I approach it, is the question of how does this world show up for us as it does? I see you and all these rich, meaningful surroundings around me. How does this show up for us? And I think that the key thing to realize is that to tell the story, we need to realize that The way the world shows up to us is as available. It's accessible. I can turn my head over here and look at that. I can turn my head over there and look at that. I can reach out and touch this. And if we want to understand the world's availability, we realize that part of it depends on our brains, part of it depends on our bodies, part of it depends on our landscapes, part of it depends on what's going on around us, part of it depends on people and other influences, so that ultimately we need to proceed to understand consciousness by looking at our active interaction with the world around us. So the brain is a crucial part of the story. It's just not the whole story.
Well, I can go along with the idea that consciousness of physical experience is external, but what about the intellectual aspects of consciousness, like thinking about what you have written in your book or coming up with ideas for my own book?
Yeah, that's a great question. The key thing there is to realize that we think with tools, and some of the tools we think with are words. We think with our hands and pens when we write. We think with our fingers when we tap away at the keyboard. I'm thinking with my body now while I'm talking to you, constructing my thoughts in response to you, and I'm listening to you. So there's a lot more going on here than just stuff inside my head. Part of what's going on is that I'm deploying tools which are shared, which are cultural, which are learned, which are outside of me.
You cite a study with bacterium to make this point, but bacterium don't have language. They don't have all the other things you've just talked about.
Actually, bacteria don't play a very big role in my story. The point I make about bacteria is that when we look at a bacterium, we don't actually take up, at least when we're doing biology, we don't normally take up a sort of a purely mechanical or reductionist attitude to it. We think of the bacterium as a whole, occupying an environmental niche, responding to stimuli, pursuing ends like, you know, greater concentrations of glucose on which it will feed itself. And even when we try to take a sort of purely empirical attitude towards the bacterium, we end up taking a kind of narrative. We view the bacterium as playing a role in a saga with needs and interests, and with
so we're anthropomorphizing them.
I think actually we're not anthropomorphizing it, but we're in order to bring the organism itself into focus as an organism to do science with it, we need to realize that it doesn't reduce merely to a mechanical set of processes.
What about other animals? Are you making the same claim for animals all the way up the scale from insects to primates?
Yeah, mind is not the property of human beings alone. And in the animals that we're close to, and I don't necessarily mean the animals that we're evolutionarily close to, but the animals that we know and live with and work with, like our dogs and our cats, it's very difficult for people even to take seriously the thought that these creatures are not bearers of points of view and feelings and thoughts, that there isn't a world that shows up for them. And if we try to think, and this is the interesting paradox, if we try to think of them just as mechanical systems or just as neurophysiological systems or just as behavioral systems, we can't actually bring that conception of them as having minds to bear. So there's this weird paradox where on the one hand, we can't help but view them as having minds, but then when we try to do science of a certain kind, behavioristic science, neurophysiological science, we can't find any place for mind. And my thought is that in order to bring mind into focus as a natural phenomenon, we need to take up a different kind of perspective than the reductionist neurological one or the behavioristic one. And what I say in the book is that we need to take up the biological perspective, but the biological perspective that allows us to experience the animal as a unified whole with interests and needs playing a role. And this is exactly the perspective of Darwinian evolutionary theory, I think.
What is the grand illusion hypothesis, and why do you reject it?
Well, this is a long and interesting story. You know, so much science of the mind begins with the idea that, you know, what we are aware of is really just patterns of, say, in the visual. Just take the visual case because it's a simple one to just restrict our attention to. So the retina is stimulated by the light, and the seeing happens inside of us in our brain. So essentially, we occupy an interior zone. We're sort of trapped in the caverns of our own consciousness. And what's going on outside to have produced that light in the first place is simply that of which we know nothing.
Well, we say that the parts of the brain light up when that happens, and different parts of the brain light up when different stimuli are sent to the brain.
Sure. But what the point I was trying to get to is that it's just the wrong the conclusion we're forced to if we take that starting point is that the world is a kind of creation of the brain, that the brain simply builds up a representation of you and everything around me now on the basis of that stimulation. I have a very different starting point, and I think it's a more productive starting point. Instead of thinking of what we see as what projects to the eyes, and therefore think of seeing as something that happens in my brain, I think of what is visible to me now as what is available to me now, where that means what is available to me thanks to what I know, thanks to what I can do, thanks to the way I can move my head and eyes and body, thanks to the conceptual skills I can deploy. And from that standpoint, one interesting upshot of that is I can see much more than what projects to my eyes. For instance, when I look at you now across the table, I have a sense of you as a three-dimensional whole. Of course, I can't see the behind of your body because it's out of view. It's hidden by you. On the other hand, I have a perceptual sense of its presence, and that consists in the fact that it's accessible to me now. All I need to do is get up and walk around and take a look.
But do you believe that other mental processes beyond perception, like memory, intellectual thought, imagination, dreaming, are also external to the brain?
You use the phrase external to the brain, and I want to just be careful about that. It's in no way my opinion that any aspect of our mental life is independent of our brain. The brain is necessary for conscious experience of every kind. The point that I'm trying to suggest is that it's not alone sufficient for experience. The brain plays a role as part of a larger story.
But you're saying the older model is almost solipsistic, even though
exactly
nobody would, no scientist would want to accept that idea.
Well, the funny thing is that if you pick up any book written by a scientist that's trying to popularize what they're doing, they always have chapter headings like "The perceptual world is really a grand illusion." I mean, this is actually this is kind of the way they dramatize the upshot of their own view. You know, dreaming is an interesting case. One interesting question is it possible to dream any experience? The tradition, the tradition that comes down to us from Descartes always said, I can't know whether I'm not now dreaming because any test I might perform to tell whether I'm dreaming is something I might be dreaming that I'm performing. And so maybe it's all a dream. We can't tell. But it's an interesting empirical question, whether in fact any experience that I can have is an experience that I could have in a dream. If you answer that question affirmatively, you're assuming that the brain on its own, without ongoing stimulation over time from the outside world, is capable of doing that. And in fact, I think there's good empirical reason for thinking that is not the case.
Artists realize that they can't invent a shape that they haven't already experienced.
That's a good example. Yeah.
My guest is Alvin Noe, who's written a book called Out of Our Heads, Why Are You Not Your Brain? Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. It is published by Hill and Wang. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alvin Noe, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's also a member of the Institute of Cognitive and Brain Sciences. His previous book was called Action in Perception. And now we have Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, published by Hill and Wang. You said earlier that scientists are starting to talk with philosophers. So how are they responding to what you're saying, since you're going against pretty much everything they've been claiming for quite a few years now?
Well, this dialogue has been going on between me and the larger cognitive science community for a while now. And what's interesting is that I think there's a sense among so many that actually the sort of the brain is the only thing that matters approach is actually coming up against a dead end. There's really, at the moment, there's not even a sort of sketch on the back of the envelope idea of how the action of brain cells alone might give rise to consciousness. So people I think recognize that it's time to try to think of new ways of conceptualizing the materials out of which we want to try to shape a theory.
You also say that habits and skills are fundamental to consciousness.
Yeah, that's a key thing for me. A notion that plays an important role in my thinking is the idea of availability and access. If I come into a room and there's some graffiti on the wall in a language I don't know, it's just marks on the wall. If I come into a room and it's graffiti on the wall in a language I do know, it might make my face blush with offense. My background knowledge is spontaneously brought to bear in what I encounter in the world, and in being brought to bear enables the meaning of this graffiti on the wall to affect me. And I think that's actually a nice paradigm for the way in which, in this case, a kind of linguistic skill unlocks the world for me.
What is the relationship of human consciousness to other cultural systems like social structures?
That's something I'm not really expert in. I haven't done a lot of, you know, thought about cross-cultural comparative issues. But one thing I'll say just kind of that really grows up as much as anything out of my own life experience is that I think we're very much attuned to our environments, and we grow ways of being based on the habits that are of our local culture. And one of the reasons why that's important is that there's a lot of forced migration, forced immigration in this world we live in, thanks to war and poverty and other forms of, you know, dislocation. And I think that one of the sort of upshots of my way of thinking about these questions is that that kind of dislocation is deeply damaging to a person, because we are so, in my view, dependent on our involvement with the world around us. If you take a person out of home and force them into an environment which is very different, it's traumatic of what they are.
Are people less conscious if they're incurious or inattentive or, for whatever reasons, don't interact with the outside world well?
That's a lovely question.
I'm not talking about autism, which may very well, everything may still be going into the brain. Yeah. They just may not be acting or reacting the way others do. But that's also an interesting aspect
of this,
isn't it?
No, this is a great line of thought. I was actually just yesterday at the Drawing Center talking to a group of people sort of in the New York art world. And one of the things that came up in my presentation is the idea that art actually provides people an opportunity for new kinds of understanding, which then in turn enable them to have new kinds of experiences. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why it's so important to have art in our school curricula, because what you're really doing is you are imparting, and this is true of education as a whole, you're imparting skills that make the world available. And yes, I would suppose that to the extent to which any of us is lazy or stuck or unable sometimes to get new skills, new habits, new understanding, then to that extent we live in a limited world.
Much of your book deals with the faults and strengths of imagination in understanding consciousness. Do scientific and philosophical and artistic investigation use imagination differently?
No, actually. I would say that the imagination, in terms of its role in the creative life of scientists and artists, is actually really, really very similar. I'm often struck by how similar the sort of cognitive, imaginative investment of scientists and artists are.
Does your theory have ethical, practical, or other tangible consequences?
Other tangible consequences. Well, I am a philosopher, after all. I don't really have to justify what I do by tangible consequences. But no, as a matter of fact, it does. Although it depends upon what you mean by tangible. For me, one of the upshots of my book is I'll even use the word spiritual. On my view, we are at home in the world. We are not trapped inside our heads. We are not aliens in a strange universe trying to figure out what's going on around us on the basis of patterns of light banging against the cells in our eyes. We are responsive. We are integrated. We are at home. We are involved. And I think that actually gives us a different picture, not only of how we feel about ourselves, but how we feel about other people and how we feel about other animals. And I would say that that has ethical implications.
How does this extend to other kinds of work, for example, robotic development? Because there is also an attempt in robotics these days to create artificial consciousness.
I think that's another great question, and I think that's absolutely an important line of research, one that I'm very much supportive of. But I think that one of the problems is that our roboticists have tended to make the mistake, along with the rest of cognitive science, of thinking that our basic character is intellectual. What we do is we figure things out. We look, we represent the world to ourselves, we form a plan about how to act on the basis of that internal representation, and then we our brain signals our body to produce a motor output. My feeling is that really, if we want to make robots that have minds like us, and I don't see any reason, any deep principled reason why we can't, we really need to make robots that have habits like ours, robots that are integrated with the environments around them in the way that we are. It might turn out, something that I suspect will turn out, is that the only way to make an artificial mind will be to actually make an artificial life form, because it's really only with this phenomenon we call life that you get that kind of intimate dynamic coupling of the minded agent with the world around it that allows us to have mind in the first place.
My guest is Alvin Noe, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book, Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, published by Hill and Wang. How did the idea for this book begin? Was it something that grew out of research, or was it something that grew out of philosophical speculation?
The philosophical speculation, I when you say that, I have the slight feeling that you mean something slightly pejorative by that.
No, I don't. I just simply mean, were you sitting around one day and did an idea occur to you, as opposed to reading something in the research that then led you to rethink a problem?
Yeah.
I see nothing wrong with philosophical speculation. There's some pretty great philosophers throughout the history of the world.
Yeah, that's right. The issue is a live problem, and it's a problem. One of the things I don't actually accept is the idea that there are problems for science and problems for philosophy. There are differences between philosophical problems and scientific problems, but both science and philosophy have to grapple with both of them. So philosophical, conceptual, methodological issues arise for science, and empirical questions arise for philosophy. Now, as I said earlier, the whole problem of what is the mind, what is its relation to our body and the world around us, this is a live problem for all of us, right? It's a live problem for any aspect of human learning. And there's just a rich dialogue going on between philosophers and scientists. I've had a number of collaborators over the years, and together with them, I have... since I was a graduate student, I've been convinced that a certain establishment orthodoxy about how to approach these questions isn't going anywhere. It ends up giving us a false conception of ourselves. So my first book, Action and Perception, was very much written for a sort of cognitive science and neuroscience audience. And then I came to feel that in order to really reach the cognitive scientists, in order to really reach the establishment, I actually needed to bring in the general public, because the general public is smart and the general public sort of will hold a fire to the scientists. And also I feel there's so much, you can't open up the newspaper without reading the discovery of the fMRI brain basis of something or other. And I thought there's just too much hype about this brain stuff. I need to try to bring in the public to this discussion. I somehow think of cognitive science as like a big dinner party, and it's time to pull our chairs back from the table and widen the discussion. And then actually just one more thought about that. I also feel that this whole problem of consciousness, it isn't just a scientific problem. It's really a problem about how we understand ourselves. The motto of the book is a little line from a Delmore Schwartz poem. I no more wrote than read that book, which is the self I am. And in a way, that's the spirit in which this book is written. We are a kind of puzzle to ourselves.
But isn't that the realm of psychology? I realize that psychology also grows out of philosophy. But... psychology is separate from neurobiology, isn't it?
Every day I get letters from psychologists and neurobiologists and dancers. And in other words, a lot of people take an interest in these results. And I'm
because they all see it as applying to themselves in a different way.
That's right. Because it's a question of what are we? What is our human nature?
Well, you mentioned making it accessible to the public. Hasn't a problem in philosophy been, at least in the post-Wittgensteinian era, that the public has no idea what the heck philosophers are talking about?
That's true, isn't it, in so many aspects of life? That is what goes on in the arts or in music and sort of, in the 20th century so often seems unavailable to the wider public.
Well, for example, pretty much every educated person of a certain era would have read Nietzsche.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine too many people today are reading contemporary philosophers.
Well, I think you underestimate the sort of cultural reception of philosophy. It's not... I don't think you're pointing at something special about philosophy. I think what you're pointing to is something that happens when a conversation goes on and on. If you get to a dinner party late, there's a conversation that's already going on, and it's going to take you a few minutes to pick up the threads, to realize the positions that have been staked out. And philosophy is a conversation that's been going on. Science is a conversation that's been going on. And that was precisely why I felt it was important to try to write a book that didn't already presuppose that you'd been at the beginning of the conversation, for just that reason, to try to make it accessible. one of the problems with any kind of technical discourse, or, you know, where you get involved with jargon, is that it actually muddies your own thinking. It muddies the scientist or the philosopher's own thinking. Daniel Dennett once said to me that whenever you organize an academic meeting, make sure you have undergraduates there, because it'll keep you honest. In other words, you have to speak so you're understood instead of just sort of speaking as if you're understood.
And Daniel Dennett gave you a nice blurb for this book.
Yeah.
Getting back to the whole idea of the external affecting consciousness, what happens with people who have sight problems or hearing problems? Does that diminish their consciousness?
It doesn't diminish it, but it certainly changes it. My view is that the world shows up for us thanks to the skills we have to reach out and secure contact with it. And there's different styles of skillful access to the world. There's different. That's what a sensory modality is, in my view. So if you lose your eyesight, you lose one way of investigating the space around you, the people around you, the events around you, but you don't lose other ways. And one thing which is interesting that I discuss in my work is that there's different ways of losing your perceptual access to the world around you. One way to lose it would be to have your sensory organ itself, your sensitivity, be damaged. But another way to lose it would be to have your ability to make use of that sensory stimulation to explore the world be damaged. And there's wonderful studies that show that if you put on left-right inverting goggles, even though they don't actually distort or bend the light, they simply make things on the left affect you the way something on the right would affect you, it has the effect of making everything blurry and distorted. And I think that the reason for that is that now all of a sudden, although you're having perfectly good sensory stimulation, you no longer understand how it hangs together with your own movements, with your own gestures, with your own curiosity about what's going on around you. And sensory stimulation that is not coupled with the skills is as good as no sensory stimulation at all, or maybe not quite that bad, but it's a problem.
You've said earlier that you're really going against a 200-year-old paradigm, and these sorts of things get held on to. The people whose whole lives and careers have been based on a certain concept are not going to give it up too easily. Are you facing a certain amount of opposition within the scientific community?
It's a good fight. It's a good fight. But I think most of the parties to the fight are well-meaning and are honest and are trying to challenge me where they think they can and trying to learn from me where they think they can.
And what about in the area of philosophy?
The same is true in philosophy. I'm leaving here to go meet with a group of philosophers at NYU who I expect to try to beat me up.
That's part of the fun, isn't it?
It is.
Arguing with people who are maybe as smart as you are, even smarter.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in my view, the essence of philosophy is to through argument, through conversation, to acquire new understandings that actually change the way you see these questions and problems. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to start a public discussion about this question.
And now you've gone to the general public with this book. The big problem in doing something like this and is writing it in a way that everybody will understand. You said that's why you think about getting some students into any discussion of things. But this still is rather difficult to get your head around, isn't it?
Some of these ideas are. But, you know, I've been really actually heartened by the availability of the book to people. One of my best critics is my mother, and she's not an academic.
Alva Noe is a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's a member of the Institute of Cognitive and Brain Sciences. His book, Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, is from Hillen Wang. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.